This is Ladson Hinton, Tale of Little Brother, Little Sister, November 18th, 1991.
Monday, November 18th, 1991. Lecture by Ladson Hinton, Tales and Stories, Their Meaning and Interpretation.
Self-arranged here a little bit. It's nice of you all to be here despite the inclement weather and so forth. Just read a couple. I don't know if y'all read the New York Times Book Review. I don't have time to read books these days, but I try to read the book review so I can sound real smart and erudite and so forth. But there was a book reviewed there by Daniel Bennett called Consciousness Explained, which has to do with the latest computer models of the brain and this or that sort of thing. It's after Julian Jaynes, The Bicameral Mind, and that so forth. But a couple of interesting quotes that substantiate that actually some of these far-out Jungian theories and so forth about fairy tales, maybe they actually have some other sort of grounding too. I'll quote what he speaks about in terms of how the mind works. These are the words of the reviewer. His way is to propose what he calls a Joycean machine, that is James Joyce, a kind of mental operating system that acts as a controller, filtering the cacophony of inner voices into silent narrative, a stream of consciousness. Riding on top of the neural machinery, the hardware of the brain, is a program that simulates a serial computer, creating a step-by-step narrative from the tumult unfolding in the world and in the head. So he sees the narrative farm telling the story as kind of part of the most basic nature of consciousness and the psyche. Of course, I mean, that makes the most common sense in the world, but, it often seems like some of this highfalutin science doesn't make that much common sense. So it's nice to feel in agreement with all that. Everyone here all right back there? Perfect. And so I approach this task of comprehending the meaning of tales and stories with the humility born of experience. Quite a few years ago, just after I finished my analytic training, as a matter of fact, I was pressed into service to teach seminars at the San Francisco Institute. I don't know if I should be too flattered about that, because the fact is that no one else had much interest in the subject at the time. But as true of so many things in life, my involvement in this case was rather fortuitous. My interest was genuine. I plunged in like the younger sibling in the fairy tale, who is so naive and yet unprejudiced, he will take on the most impossible-seeming tasks. For when I entered into the area more fully and consciously, I found, to my dismay, vast compendiums and commentaries from every possible point of view. I found scholarship of monumental proportions, which endlessly classified and analyzed fairy tales. There is a reality, too, of the sheer abundance of the tales themselves from every region of the world. Some themes in fairy tales have been traced back at least 25,000 years, animal stories probably being the oldest. They're traced back somewhat to the Paleolithic art and how the certain areas of that art do seem to depict fairy tales which are still discernible in the folklore of Europe. I was properly humbled by all this and continue to be so. I still think of my knowledge in the area as a beginning, a little window. For these reasons, I try to stay close to what I know best in discussing fairy tales and stories. Psychology and its various clinical and symbolic dimensions, and philosophy. I will approach the subject in two separate segments. First, I will discuss some general perspectives on tales and stories, ending with a small clinical experience. In the second half, I will analyze the Grimm's tale, Little Brother and Little Sister. We're lucky enough tonight to have Margaret Swanson Vance to tell us the story of Little Brother and Little Sister in between the two parts. In the earliest times, according to the scholars, wealth and status were often measured more by the stories a man knew, the rituals he was authorized to conduct, than by the cattle and possessions he had accumulated. There's a sense of nostalgia, a sort of longing for the golden age, which overtakes us when we read or hear old tales. The Brothers Grimm, along with others in the 19th century who became enamored of tales and stories, held the belief that there had been an ancient system of wisdom predating Christianity, of which the tales were the remains. The Grimms used metaphors such as a broken crystal whose fragments you find scattered in the grass. That is, the tale is a fragment of what once was a vast unified body of wisdom or lore in ancient times. Indeed, in the telling of stories, there is always the sense of being transported into another dimension of time. Old family stories give a larger perspective than the facts of the present as well. We feel a larger history moving through us. Fantasy writing takes us in a special way to a different dimension or a distant future. The best movies may do this as well. The fairy tale does this in a most profound way. Once upon a time lends a timeless quality. We are lifted out of our ego-bound immediacy. As the tale begins, there is a certain mood, a shift, an altered consciousness which quickly occurs. Even in the preparation for the telling, there is a mood, a special anticipation. During the telling, there is a suspension of everyday consciousness, of controlled, directed consciousness. There is a sense of depth, dimension, and excitement. The ego sets aside the usual burdens of goals and defenses and is open to another sort of world. The tale has a remarkably stimulating and invigorating effect when compared to a purely linear description. We just take this fact for granted, and yet it seems rather remarkable when you actually think about it. For instance, I was quite dismayed several years back when a professional group was pervaded by conflict between the older and younger members. I became compulsively engrossed in the issues, trying to see the logic, endlessly analyzing, speculating on causes, compromises, trying to understand the personalities of the individuals involved, and so forth. An older German friend was sitting off in a corner looking very content with himself amidst the storm. His attitude evoked my curiosity, and I went over to ask his opinion. He looked at me when I inquired, smiled, and said, "That's the way it always goes. The young bulls joust with the old bulls." This is a very simple statement, barely a story, but I felt relief and a return of energy. I stopped obsessing about the situation, and though still involved, started enjoying it. We must ask what happened, why this shift of mood, of relationship to inner and outer reality at this very simple remark. My ego had been very involved in the need to fix and control things, to make the world orderly and secure. Probably on some level there were vestiges of memories of old family conflicts of my own, awareness of my own inner conflicts, my own impulses, aggressions, shadow businesses projected on the situation, and so forth. The tiny story got me entirely out of that mode. I speculate that what happened was a sudden shift to a larger, deeper reality, a sense that my own limited little story was playing itself out on the background of a much larger story, the eternal tension of old and young. I speculate, too, that in such shifts there is also an intuition of connection to the unfolding story of life as a whole. The human race is living a story with its eternal themes, and we are a part of that whether we consciously realize it or not. A little remark at the right time, a little story, can give us that awareness. We experience a quiet joy and a sense of meaning. Is there a glimpse here of some kind of karmic destiny? Jung was always speaking of the self as the rhizome of which we are the shoots. Does each little story, each little tale, transport us into awareness of the profoundly deeper life which lives in and through our individual lives? This is a mystery, but the joy and meaning tales give us makes me think it is so. Von Franz says that all fairy tales describe one and the same psychic fact, the self. Bettelheim emphasizes the same idea in his own language, asserting that fairy tales speak simultaneously to all levels of personality, ego, superego, and id. Thus, we experience wholeness when we experience a tale. We are put more deeply in touch with the mysterious movement of the life force itself, the primal vitality which is endlessly evolving and elaborating itself. The story mirrors how we, in our human ways, live out the primal story of suffering and transcendence as we struggle along the road of life. We learn, too, that struggle and pain are always part of the path. Fairy tales touch all levels of the psyche. They teach basic coping mechanisms and generally engender a sense of optimism about persisting through conflict. But beyond simple teaching of precepts, one is put in touch with the self, the unfolding of the life energy in all its aspects. We feel the terrible and joyful dance of life that emerges in the play of opposites, the strange drama of creation and destruction that we see endlessly. Fairy tales and all deep stories put us in touch with the ebullient energy that underlies all life, and that is affirming and optimistic at the core, no matter how the vicissitudes of life trouble our ego consciousness. They give us renewal and meaning. Psychotherapy is made up of two Greek word roots, psuche, which means breath or soul, and therapia, which means service. To be of service to the soul and to serve the breath of life is the calling of the psychotherapist. It is an awesome responsibility, and yet this perspective grounds us as it ennobles our task. Whatever one does in the field, from social measures to teaching coping skills to dream analysis, when done in the service of the soul, the breath, they are at some level psychotherapeutic. In individual work, the levels involved vary greatly from dyad to dyad. In the long run, however, all levels of the psyche must be touched if a deeper wholeness is to come about. Mere coping without the perspective of ultimate purpose and meaning becomes dreary and profane. Endless immersion in dream and fantasy without the hard test of reality becomes a flighty disownment of life. Every time I meet a new person for analysis, even after 3 decades of medical and analytic experience, I feel a bit of anxiety, a hint of awe or dread. What kind of story will we uncover or create together? Can it be done at all? Each new analytic hour is an act of creation. Amidst the relationship of analyst and analysand, in the symbolic story that comes forth in the creative container, the soul will hopefully be served. By being put more clearly, fully, and consciously in touch with his or her deeper story, the analysand becomes more deeply rooted in the source of life, the self and its élan vital. Paradoxes, levels, and contradictions are inherent in the analytic process as they are inherent in all of life, even though they make us uncomfortable at times, oft times. Only story, myth, tales can give meaning to the contradictory mosaic of therapy and of life. To be of service to the soul, the deeper story or stories must be found so that individuals may consciously own them as their own and learn to joyfully elaborate them in everyday life. Regarding the use of stories or tales in the therapy situation, I do add a note of caution. A story or tale must well up in the therapist in a spontaneous way. It will not have a positive effect if it is rationally contrived. Indeed, it may have a negative effect, since it may seem like putting the best at the service of the worst. the story uses a manipulative device and will increase the person's mistrust of the therapy process and, more tragically, of the life process. Actually, all interpretation involves an expressed or implied story. There's always the aim of putting the person more deeply in touch with his or her own deeply personal tale. The story goes around an individual's ego defenses and communicates with his or her whole being. Sometimes telling a story stems from the projections and countertransference of the therapist. In that case, it often doesn't ring true, or just the opposite. One must be sensitive to that and own it as soon as possible. If the basic intent was good, this sort of error generally works out well and may itself become a meaningful part of the story of that particular dyad. The following is a very simple example, and I want to stick to simple examples, a simple example of a little story that worked in the analytic situation. I want to show you that nothing elaborate is involved. You simply use the stories that occur to you from reading or movies or whatever source. As I have said, there must be a spontaneous upwelling involved, a true response of the whole self of analyst to the whole self of the analysand. Several years ago, I was working with a woman in her middle 30s who had been engulfed in a series of destructive relationships with men. We worked very hard on understanding her developmental and family history, peer group relationships, and so forth. Some figures of the feminine self began to appear in her dreams. However, after 2 years of work, she was quite despairing because she had become involved in yet another tormenting, destructive relationship. As she talked of her pain and depression, an old story I remembered from Plato came into my mind. The story goes that once upon a time the earth was populated with very special beings. They had very large brains, two pairs of eyes that looked forwards and backwards at all times, four arms, four legs, making them very strong, speedy, and dexterous. They were such astoundingly able beings that they became a threat to the gods themselves. Then there was an emergency assembly of deities, and a heated discussion ensued. The majority thought the entire troublesome race should be eliminated since it posed such a problem. Finally, one more sympathetic god brought about an acceptable compromise. They would divide the creature into two halves, so that henceforth they would just be entirely occupied with trying to get back together and would no longer pose a threat to the gods. To quote Plato, "It is from this distant epoch, then, that we may date the innate love that human beings feel for one another, the love which restores us to our ancient state by attempting to weld two human beings into one and to heal the wound which humanity suffered." This is the origin of Eros. When I told her this story, she didn't laugh. She became very silent and tears welled up in her eyes. She was clearly moved and almost in an altered state. I was centered enough to let her be and not interfere. She left quickly after a few minutes of silence and only perfunctory talk. Later, I worried some. Had the story seemed like a put-down, adding to her sense of victimization? Would she think I was just ridiculing her and then fall more deeply into depression and despair? I was relieved when she arrived at the next session, lighter in spirit, freer and less affective about her romantic involvement. There was a marked lessening of the compulsion to stay on in the destructive relationship. This change persisted and deepened, and we both looked back on the story as a turning point. It was difficult for her to exactly articulate why it helped. She could only say that somehow the story had restored her basic sense of honor and integrity and restored her confidence that her life had meaning. So what explains this sort of response? My best hypothesis is that the story involved an honoring of the life force behind her destructive behaviors. Whatever the genesis of these behaviors, the very intensity with which she grasped onto and grappled with relationships was a passionate search, not merely a series of neurotically determined defeats which brought shame and despair. Behind the most extreme behavior, be it neurosis or addiction, there lies a search, a longing for life to be, evolve, elaborate its story and its wholeness. If this deeper drive is not honored, there can be no cure or resolution. There may be abstinence, but no deeper healing or evolution. In the familiar quote from Jung, it is not suffering which is unbearable, but meaningless suffering. Of related importance, I think the story gives and gave this person a changed time perspective. Ego time is a kind of chopped up thing experienced as a series of events like billiard balls bouncing off one another. It is a rational, mechanical sort of living. Being trapped in that mode feels constricted, unfree, and sterile. Kierkegaard called it the sickness unto death. The tale or story puts us into another time. The flow of every ever unfolding creation whose story is at once personal and particular and yet eternal and universal. The ego is relieved of the terrible burden of trying to be God if the person can turn it over in assent to the deeper life that flows through him or her. The ego can rejoice and cooperate in the drama of life unfolding, can carry out its tasks, relieved of the impossible tasks of being the self, literally. As psychologists and psychotherapists, whether we speak the Jungian story, indeed the Jungian theory, any theory is a sort of story, the Freudian story, or other kinds and combinations of stories, let us always realize and honor the yearning of the soul to connect with its source, its deeper story, the vital flow which emanates from the creative core of all life. If we foster this awareness, whatever our favorite psychological theory or story, we are truly psychotherapeutic, that is, of service to the soul. And now, might pause for a moment, and then I think Margaret is going to tell us the tale.
The story of Little Brother and Little Sister. Once upon a time, there was a brother and a sister. Little Brother said to Little Sister, "Since our mother died, we haven't had a happy hour, for our stepmother beats us every day, and when we go to her, she kicks us and drives us away. We have only hard bread crusts to eat, and the dog under the table is better off than we are, for sometimes she throws him a scrap or two. Come, let us go out into the world together. The pity of it, if our poor mother only knew." And so Little Brother took his sister by the hand, and they went out into the world. And they traveled all day over meadows and fields and rocks. And when it began raining, Little Sister said, "Look, God and our hearts are weeping together." By nightfall, they reached a large forest, and they were so worn out with misery and hunger and their long journey that they found a hollow tree and crawled into it and fell asleep. The next morning they woke after the sun had risen and was shining down upon the log. Little Brother said, "I am so thirsty. We must find a spring and get a drink. I think I hear one now." And he took his little sister by the hand, and they went and they found a spring running gurgling over the rocks. But their wicked stepmother was a witch, and she had followed after them stealthily, as witches do, and she had put a spell on all the springs in the forest. And when Little Sister came up to the spring, she heard it speak as it gurgled and flowed, saying, "If you drink of me, you will turn into a tiger. If you drink of me, you will turn into a tiger." And she cried out, "Little Brother, please don't drink of that spring, for if you do, you'll be turned into a tiger and you'll tear me to pieces." So Little Brother said, "Very well, we'll go find another one." And they went on and found another brook gurgling over the rocks. But again, Little Sister heard it speak, saying, "If you drink of me, you will be turned into a wolf. If you drink of me, you will be turned into a wolf." And so Little Sister said, "Little Brother, don't drink, for if you do, you will be turned into a wolf and you will eat me up." So
So I said, oh, very well, we'll find another one, but then I really must drink, for I am just too thirsty. And they found another spring, and as it gurgled and flowed, little sister heard it say, if you drink of me, you will be turned into a deer. If you drink of me, you will be turned into a deer. Oh, brother, don't drink, she said, for if you do, you will be turned into a deer and you will run away from me. But it was too late. Little brother had already knelt down, and as soon as the first drops had touched his lip, he turned into a deer there by the stream. And little sister threw her arms around his neck and wept bitterly. And the deer wept too and was very sad. But finally, little sister stopped crying and said, dear brother, don't cry, for I will never leave you. I will take good care of you. And she took off her golden girdle and she tied it around his neck. And she picked rushes that grew by the stream, and she plaited them into a rope, and she tied this around to the girdle, and she took the rope, and she led him into the forest. Deeper and deeper they went, until at last she came to a little hut. She looked in and saw that it was empty, and said, here, this is a good place for us. We will live here. She went in and cleaned it out, and she gathered soft ferns and mosses and made a soft bed for the fawn. And then every morning she would go out and gather roots and nuts and berries for herself and fresh grass for the fawn. And he would eat it out of her hand, and he gambolled merrily about. Oh, if only he'd had his human form, it would have been a glorious time. They lived like this for a long time alone in the forest. But the king of that country organized a great hunt. And one morning they awoke to the sound of horns and the baying of hounds and the joyous cries of hunters. In the cabin, the fawn grew restless and said, oh, little sister, you must let me out, for I long to join in. I must run free. And little sister was afraid for his safety. But he pleaded and pleaded with her. And at last she said, oh, very well, I will, but you must promise to come back here at nightfall and sleep here. I will lock the door against the cruel hunters, and you must knock and say, little sister, let me in. I won't open unless I hear those words. And then she opened the door, and the fawn ran out into the forest, and he leaped with joy. He was so glad to be free. And when the king and his huntsmen saw the beautiful beast, they gave chase, and he led them over hill and vale, but they couldn't catch him, so fleet was he. They thought they had him surrounded, but he leaped into a thicket and vanished. At nightfall, he made his way back to the hut, and he knocked and said, little sister, let me in. And the door opened, he leaped inside, and he slept soundly on his soft bed all night. The next morning, the sounds of the hunt started up again, and as soon as the fawn heard the sound of the horn and the cries of the hunters, he grew restless again and said, oh, little sister, you must let me out, or I will die. Again, she let him out, and she said, but be sure to come back at nightfall, and don't forget the words you must say. When the king and his huntsmen once again saw the deer with the golden collar, they gave chase, and once again he led them all over the woods, and was so nimble and swift that they couldn't catch him. But finally, at nightfall, they surrounded him, and one of the hunters wounded him slightly in the foot. He escaped, but he was limping and couldn't run very fast, and so one of the huntsmen followed him to the little hut there in the woods. And he watched as the fawn knocked and said, little sister, let me in. And he saw the door open and immediately close again. And then he went back to the king and told him all that he had seen. The king listened thoughtfully and said, tomorrow we shall hunt again. Well, the little sister was dismayed when her brother came in, limping and wounded. She bathed the blood away and sprinkled fresh herbs on the wound, and then said, lie down, fawn, lie down and get well. The wound was so slight that in the morning the fawn didn't even feel it anymore. And when the hunt started up again, once again he said, oh, I must join in. You must let me go. I just can't bear it. But little sister wept and said, no, no, they'll kill you. And here will I be in the forest all alone and forsaken. No, I won't let you out. But little brother said, well, then I will die of misery right here. For when I hear the sound of the horn, I just cannot bear it. What was little sister to do? Finally, she opened the door and let him out with a heavy heart. And the deer bounded joyfully into the woods. When the king saw the deer with the golden collar again, he told his huntsmen, "Chase the deer till nightfall, but make sure no harm comes to him." And so they chased. But as soon as the sun had set, the king called the huntsman to him and said, "Now take me to that cabin in the woods." And so he took him there. And the king knocked on the door and said, "Little sister, let me in." And the door opened and he stepped inside. And there he saw a girl more beautiful than any he had ever seen. She was frightened when she saw not her dear fawn, but a man with a golden crown on his head. But he spoke tenderly and kindly to her and held out his hand and said, "Will you come with me to my palace and be my wife?" "Oh, yes," she said, "but I must bring my fawn. I will never leave him." "You shall bring your fawn and have him as long as you live, and we shall take good care of him." Just then the fawn bounded into the cabin, and the girl took the rope and tied it to his collar and led him out of the hut. And then the king put the beautiful girl on the back of his horse and rode off to the palace, where the wedding was celebrated with great splendor. Now she was a queen, and they lived happily together for a long time. The fawn was well taken care of and pranced happily about in the palace gardens. But the wicked stepmother, all this time, had thought that little sister had been torn to pieces by the wild animals in the woods, and that little brother, once he had changed to a fawn, had been killed by the hunters. When she found out that they were happy and prospering, envy and jealousy settled in her heart, and she didn't have a moment's peace. She must figure out how to make misfortune fall upon them. Her own daughter, who was as ugly as the night and had only one eye, grumbled and complained, saying, "And now she's a queen. It should have happened to me. Some people have all the luck." Her mother said, "Now, now, don't fret. I'll think of something. When the time is right, I'll know what to do." Well, the time came. The queen had a beautiful baby boy while the king was out hunting. And so the old witch changed herself into a chambermaid. And she went to the castle, and she went to the very room the queen was in, and she said, "Come, my dear, I have drawn you a nice bath. It will be good for you, and will give you new strength. Now quick, before it gets cold." Her daughter was with her too, and the two of them carried the feeble queen into the bathroom and put her in the tub, and then they locked the door and ran away. For they had built such a furious fire in the bathroom that in no time at all the poor queen was smothered and died. And then the witch took a nightcap and put it on her daughter's head and put her in the queen's place in the bed. And she gave her the face and appearance of the queen, but she couldn't restore the eye, and so the daughter had to lie on the side where her eye was gone. Well, when the king got back from the hunt and heard that he had a beautiful baby boy, he was delighted and ran to the queen's chamber to see how she was doing. But the old woman stopped him, saying, Don't open that curtain, for she can't see the light of day yet. She needs to gain her strength. And so he stepped back and didn't see that a false queen was lying in the bed. But that night at midnight, when the whole palace was asleep except for the nurse who was sitting by the cradle in the nursery, the door to the nursery opened, and the real queen came in. And she walked over to the cradle, and she picked up the child out of it and held it to her breast and suckled it. And then she plumped up his little pillow, and she put him back in bed, and she pulled his little quilt over him. And then, not forgetting the deer, she went over to the corner where he was sleeping and gently stroked his back. And then she disappeared. Nurse wondered greatly, and in the morning she went to the guards and she said, "Did you see anyone come in the palace last night?" And they said, "No, not a soul." After that, many nights the queen came. Always she never spoke a word, but she suckled the baby and stroked the fawn, and then she left. And the nurse was afraid to mention it to anyone. But after this had gone on for some time, one night the queen came in again, and this time she spoke. She said, "How's my fawn and how's my child? I'll come twice more, then never again." The nurse didn't say anything, but she went straight to the king afterwards and told him everything. My God, he said, "How could this be? Tonight I shall keep watch." And so that night he sat by the cradle and watched, and sure enough, at midnight, in came the queen. And she said, "How's my child and how's my fawn? I'll come once more, then never again." And again she suckled her child and stroked the fawn and left. And the king didn't dare say anything. He still wondered at it all. But the next night, she came again and she said, "How's my child and how's my fawn? I've come for the last time. I'll never come again." And then the king couldn't stand it any longer, and he crossed the room in one bound and said, "Are you really my true wife? You must be." And she said, "Yes, I am your wife." And by God's grace, at that moment, life was returned to her, and the roses came back to her cheeks. And she told him all that the wicked stepmother and her daughter had done. And so the king had a trial, and the stepmother and her daughter were sentenced. And the daughter was put out into the woods and was torn to pieces by wild animals, while the witch was put into a fire and was miserably burned. And when the old witch had turned to ashes, the spell was off of the fawn, and he got his human form back again. And so the little brother and sister lived happily together for the rest of their lives.
Last Monday, I ruined probably your senses of humor by overanalyzing humor. Now this week, I have to destroy the spell of a wonderful tale by actually talking about it and analyzing it. So I apologize in advance. So the curse of the overactive intellect or something. This Grimm's tale, A Little Brother and Little Sister, as you have seen, is a very moving story with many, many levels. It was brought more fully to my own attention by a woman I saw in analysis for several years. She was a physically and emotionally abused person whose life was fraught with pain and struggle. She would fit what we now call, this was many years ago before the term was so current, the borderline personality category. The tale gave her hope as a roadmap of possible development. In this discussion now, I will cover only those aspects which stand out for me. Indeed, it would be possible to write an entire volume on this tale if one were to analyze it to the last detail. First of all, we have little brother and little sister, male and female children who sound almost like twins. Immediately, one senses hope and dynamism in the pair. It is important that this is not the tale of a single individual. Already in the beginning, there is clear tension of opposites and a feeling of potential. The initial setting of the story sounds like an abusive situation. The real mother, the good mother, is dead. The children are beaten every day by their stepmother, the bad mother. The mother world is drastically split, and the father is totally absent. Little brother, the embryonic yang element, initiates movement. Through the moving statement, then, that God and our hearts are weeping together, we know the journey is in harmony with the workings of the self, the urge towards evolution and transformation. The macrocosm is in tune with the microcosm, and the divine participates in the children's suffering. God and our hearts are weeping together. I think indeed this could be the title, as well as Little Brother and Little Sister. It's a wonderful, beautiful phrase. Little Brother and Little Sister take the existential risk of leaving the daily round of meaningless neurotic suffering symbolized by the daily abuse of the stepmother. One could very well apply this more inwardly and subjectively as the abuse that's reminiscent of the battering of inner emotional complexes, which are banal in their cyclic repetition of moods and fears. We've all experienced an entrapment in such cycles of inner abuse as well. When one takes the leap of venturing into new psychological territory, it seems frightening, lonely, and terribly exposed. The abusive situation has been at least known, strangely comforting in its familiarity. To leave it involves risk. Out in the open, exposed to the vicissitudes of nature, and of one's own nature. But the reward is beyond price, for the chosen suffering in the service of individuation puts one in touch with and in harmony with the deeper movement of the self. When God weeps with you, everything is possible. Many initial sessions in psychotherapy fit this scenario. The individual takes the initiative to come to your office to seek a way out of an emotionally destructive life. There is shame and loneliness involved in this action, a sense of exposure and danger. Appropriate and empathic responses by the therapist can, hopefully, convey the sense that, yes, change is painful, but now it is chosen suffering in the service of individuation. In that light, much can be endured. Little brother and little sister soon run into new dangers. The first taste of freedom is exhilarating, but psychic evolution is never so easy. We escape from an obvious difficulty only to find the problem has taken more subtle and inner form. Even though the day looks bright and sunny to little brother and little sister, there is danger in naively rushing to drink of the first experiences life offers. The first breath of freedom gives a kind of inflation to one. While little brother and little initiated the journey, though, a little sister indeed manifests some special psychic powers here. She's the yin principle, receptive to the deeper voices of nature. It is she who can hear the warnings of the springs. There's a tendency in all of us to recreate abusive situations, the repetition compulsion. The euphoria of freedom puts us off guard. To become a raging tiger or a ravenous wolf would be to become the abuser. Little brother would destroy the soul, the little sister. It is terribly important to realize when the deeper psychic structures are not strong enough to deal with the powerful instinctual forces symbolized by these animals. Developmentally, this is related to the necessity, and this is seen in most dramatic form in borderline personalities, to disidentify from the raw affects which pour through the psyche. There is an addictive quality to these powerful emotions, and it is all too tempting to drink again and again from those springs. The sheer intensity of the energies makes one feel temporarily godlike. But the self-structures cannot contain them, and the result is a terrible cycle of internal chaos, turmoil, shame, and despair, followed by the painful process of reorganization. On the other hand, we must remember that affective vitality, the animal knowing deep in our nature, is something without which we cannot fully live. A left brain suppressive therapy taken too far can result in a mechanical caricature of a human being. Many years of therapeutically reinforced rational coping with life on a merely behavioral level can lead to pathological disconnection from the wellsprings of life. Medications can reinforce this tendency. A normal-seeming person emerges, but the soul connection is missing. Such individuals often say that it is as if someone else were leading their lives. They feel unreal, chronically dissociated, like imposters. Sometimes they take the risk of a therapy to undo the earlier therapy. And so one must finally drink at the wellsprings of life, despite the danger. If caution totally prevails, life will not take place. This is a basic developmental truth. Resisting the raging tiger and the ravenous wolf prepares little brother to take the plunge, finally. A man must listen to the anima and then decide what course is in the deeper service of life, or else the positive anima mother just becomes another protective trap. The fawn, which little brother becomes, is an affectionate, gentle creature. It is a wild animal, but needs protection. Little sister, indeed, is very patient and nurturing, carrying the energies of the positive mother. It is like a tiny marriage of caring and tenderness, cemented by the golden girdle which she puts about his neck. But however, the situation is still incomplete. The protective containment is important for a time as new experiences and progresses are integrated. It is relevant to recall again that there is no father, no initiation master present to buffer the primal life energies. Manifested by the terrible mother, the dark power of the unconscious presents through the story in its various forms. But there has been no father, no initiation master figure. The picture is that of an initiation, then, which comes mostly from within and from the autonomous initiative of the deeper self. The plight of the borderline person is just such a premature exposure to raw archetypal energies. The parents, at worst, inflict these emotions upon the child, or at best fail in their roles as mediators. The result in the borderline adult is a recurrent chaos of rapidly shifting emotional states without inner buffering or modulation. This chronically devours life purposes, the dark devouring mother within. Outer relationships rarely last when tigers and wolves, rages and hungers, are unleashed boundlessly. Then the rage may finally be turned against the self. Such a destructive trap has been successfully avoided by little brother and little sister, and this important developmental progress must be given time now, again, to consolidate. The island of peace and progress is tempting, but life must go on. Otherwise, one would end up stuck at the fawning level, a life of obsequious dependency. People arrested at this stage are often sensitive, but terribly defensive, always fearing danger or disruption when the hunter's horn sounds. They tend to look to a more powerful spouse, boss, or political leader to protect them from life. Often they exert a plaintive claim on life, the life they so fear to undertake. They feel entitled to endless protection and solicitude due to their earlier sufferings. But woe be unto the person, the therapist sometimes, who frustrates or confronts their needy control. Rage babbles forth in a great tirade, and they indulge in endless self-righteous justifications for the harm this rage causes. When the horn sounds and the dogs bark, when the hunter's cries are heard, there is a stirring which must be honored. It is the call to more, to deeper life. The sound of the horn is a primal announcement and summons. Horn, indeed, is related to the Indo-European word root for power. And hunters know the ways of animals in the forest. Here finally enters the figure of the initiation master who was missing before. We are dealing here, then, with the possibility of further initiation and differentiation. There's always the question, will one heed the call or settle for a lesser life? The anima mother may whisper in a man's ear, stay put, it's dangerous out there, just don't take the risk. A woman may be immobilized by lack of confidence that her own embryonic animus can deal with new experiences, and so she withholds herself from life, never really engaging the world with her full being. The fawn's strange wildness and intoxication are reminiscent of the earlier dangerous flirtations with the springs. He is bloody and wounded, however, and one must let him go, or life would not take place, though. We know how parents can overprotect. Therapists all too frequently do the same thing, warning so severely of reality dangers that the deeper impetus toward individuation is suppressed. One of the most difficult things to do as a parent or as a therapist is to sit by and watch, comforting as one can, while the individual responds to the call to life and is thereby blooded. Blooding is part of individuation and initiation. The king turns out to be wise and perspicacious. He has the golden crown of awareness, a mature version of the Golden Girdle. There ensues an idyllic interlude of palace life while things are integrated at a higher level. The fawn situation, however, is still present, signifying incompleteness. Sure enough, the stepmother reappears like a terrible complex from which one had thought to have been freed forever. But the complex is also a challenge to continue to evolve. Our complexes plague us, but they are also our useful gadflies. It is revealed that the stepmother is motivated by envy and jealousy. These are the most uncanny emotions for a child to experience from a parent. The child cannot fathom that a seemingly all-powerful being could be envious of them. The experience is usually taken in by the child as a primal sense of shame and awfulness about the self. In psychotherapy, if the reality of parental envy can be seen, it re-empowers the individual, for only a potent being could be envied. This step is often difficult because the person has become addicted to rage at the abusive parent, and to see the parent as envious and needy requires setting aside the rage. That initially feels like loss of power, and so is a difficult obstacle. Little sister, now the adult queen, is boiled to death, like being consumed in the fire of forgotten emotions. She is postpartum, a particularly vulnerable time for women emotionally. Here is a last test, perhaps, of her readiness for motherhood. Could the chambermaid witch sneak into the mother's psyche and turn her into an abuser? Can she persist despite the awful fire of destructive emotions? The king is out hunting, a strange thing to do at such a crucial time. He knows about animals and hunting, but seems a bit unconscious of the needs of the feminine side of himself. Perhaps he too has a bit too much of the intoxication with the hunt, the remaining taint of the fawn. It represents inwardly the failure of the animus to aid a woman in evaluating moods and affects, to give consciousness of what should come in the door and what shouldn't. However, the nurse does see. The persistent Hestia-like quality one saw earlier in Little Sister is now fully developed and aware. The nurse tends the small flame of new life amidst ashes and darkness. She observes the deeper happenings of the soul. The guards, representing the collective, see nothing. The apparently dead queen shows how love and devotion can win out over great obstacles. In this, she shows a readiness for a full life as a mother and as a spiritually and psychologically mature woman. It is at the time of darkness, death, and negredo that it is most difficult to hold loving faith in the meaning and purpose of life. There is a hint here of the Gnostic Sophia, whose toughest task is to remember the light when there is only darkness. The king is finally able to listen to the nurse. He is not a closed man, but is able to respond to the deeper sensitivities of his nature, even though it goes beyond collective norms and beliefs. His witch anima in the bed has only one eye, indicating a half-conscious awareness of the feminine. He must let himself see with his whole being and respond with his whole being. When he does, the queen returns to life, her cheeks rosy red, and the witch and her daughter are returned to the elemental forces from which they emerged in a typical homeopathic resolution. The fawn is freed. The king is now a mature man, and he is ready for a true connection with his now mature queen. It is a true syzygy, a joining of opposites, which is a profound manifestation of the self. The child is the symbol of the joy and renewal which such a union can bring. Little Brother and Little Sister is an account of individuation with many levels. Originally, there is only embryonic masculine and feminine energy, which evolves in stages through temptations and pitfalls. There are many dimensions relevant to psychotherapy and to human development in general. Among other things, it deals with the all-too-common plight of the absent father and the mother who falls into darkness as she tries to carry too much. The story tells of the painful affects, temptations, and inflations, which are always parts of the individuation journey. If the voice of the soul is tended with care and respect, and the call of the self is heard when it comes, there can be an outcome of meaning and joy. That is the optimistic message of this tale. Here, yeah. Could I elaborate a little bit on the, you said the destructive power, addictive power of the affects, the addictive quality of affects. Well, any powerful affect is an inflation. That's the emotional pull of the archetypal energies, and you know, it's always tempting to kind of fall into that. Any extreme anger or you know, is really an inflation. It's a lot easier to feel as a god or goddess or something than just deal with regular human ambiguity. And of course, certain kinds of personalities who have a weak ego or the kind of the whole structure of the inner self is rather shaky, often seems to substitute a kind of primordial emotionality that gives a kind of a temporary sense of reality or life energy. It's like they don't have anything to mediate the deeper life energies, and they can't integrate those very well in their daily lives, but they can kind of just sort of submerge themselves suddenly, and it's not really, sometimes it seems a little voluntary, but it just happens, and they're temporarily are the emotion, and it's very raw and violent, and yet it does give a sense of power and meaning and identity very temporarily, like, being real drunk, or I suppose really any kind of, it is sort of like an addiction that way. It's a temporary sense of reality. It's a pseudo-reality, but if a person, then people who are sort of addicted to this, when they give it up, it's the same thing. They have withdrawal. They have to face their basic kind of real shaky position in the world. They have to integrate these affects in bits and pieces, and often the world seems pale and deflated for a long time. So, I don't know. So, they are quite addictive, but basically it's the addiction of inflation and its various manifestations, I think. Kate? Or? That when it ceases to go outwards, it manifests in physical symptoms. So you'd see the physical symptoms as a developmental progress, in a sense. At least they're experienced literally as parts of the self, the body self, in some way. Mm-hmm. I've seen that happen at times. I'd have to kind of think about it. I think it would probably be variable. That I have seen that, though, on frequent occasions. I've seen that actually with more totally psychotic people who reintegrate that way. Maybe people who are severely borderline. I know Harry Stack Sullivan wrote about that in terms of the body symptoms as a stage in reintegration or disintegration, too, depending on which direction you're going from. But no, I think there is definitely some truth in that.
So is there a danger in this affect of annihilation of the ego? Is that what the danger is?
Is there danger in affects of annihilation of the ego? Definitely. I mean, the unconscious is dangerous. And, you know, you don't, you approach the archetypal energies with full consciousness and... Sure, there are plenty of people, and I suppose it's always partly wounding. You know, you can't avoid some wounding. The ego is always partly wounded when it comes in contact with the deeper energies. Yeah, there are lots of people around who've been permanently wounded, I think, and in many ways, you're dealing with the raw energy source, and it can work for creation or destruction. Oh, Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, that if the king only got, she was only going to visit three more times, then two more times, and there was just one more time. No, I think that's really true in life, that, the self does tend to provide lots of opportunities, but I think, there's certainly nodal points in life that one can, the decision and there's a kind of a moral responsibility to embrace life, or if you don't embrace it, you've chosen not to. And people, I think, the longer they go through life not embracing it, they just sort of become vestiges of people, sort of robot-like. There's not too much soul energy, or maybe, I don't know. Who knows? Who can say what's really deep inside? I think that's an extremely important point, though, the kind of the moral choice to embrace the threat of individuation, whether it's the sound of the horn or the need of the poor queen who's just there for a certain brief kind of window of opportunity. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. It's the moral sort of existential aspect of the choice and symbolic choice. That's true. Yeah. There's no promise. You just have to take the leap, huh? You just take the leap. Otherwise, it's not genuine, is it? That if you promised it in some mechanical way, it would feel entirely different. You'd just be back in the same old logical framework of some kind that you came from, or whatever framework you did come from. That there has to be kind of a leap of faith in the deepest points of individuation, and one is graphically tested, I think, in that too. Like, oh shit, why did I ever get into this? Yeah, the faith of Little Sister is quite impressive and moving. I thought of this as the Hestia-like quality that's so undervalued, in our culture. The patient tending of life without any collective recognition, especially in our culture, our reward. It's in a certain way a version of the Cinderella story, but seen from an entirely inward point of view. The patient tending of the sacred flame with only maybe abuse, certainly without collective reward, done for its own sake. And, then I thought, too, that in the myths of Sophia, which I used to be familiar, but I've forgotten a lot, but I know the main character, I think it's called Pistis Sophia. I believe that's the Greek. It's Faith Sophia. That in the Gnostic tradition, that the greatest test of Sophia is when she's lost endlessly in the darkness and has to nourish the tiny little memory in herself of the light or the eternal flame of being, that's her greatest test. So I thought of Sophia and of Hestia in particular, but I love that quality of the tale, the faithfulness of Little Sister, and then of the nurse at the end, too, the nurse. Kind of epitomizes that faith to nursing the child and the queen, telling the king what really is going on at that deep inner level, at the soul level. That's a quality so undervalued in our culture, though. I'm glad you emphasized it. That's the Gnostic legend. Yeah, I guess it was Hellenistic in Hellenistic times. Answer to Job. I don't know. There's a whole complex mythology of Sophia, but I'm dealing just with the Gnostic part of that, which is also very complex in its own right. I was on a dissertation committee once that explored that mythology, and a woman was nice enough to teach me all about it, but it was about 20 years ago, and I've forgotten all but the little parts I just wanted to remember a lot. Margaret?
So the story is between the woman and the little brother at the end, the figure, and then you can also
Yeah, pretty much you could see the little sister is the anima figure and the little brother is animus figure, and it's a very nice tale to see the same situations from each point of view. I think it's, you know, you can do that with any tale, but this one's particularly suitable. And they kind of play out the very clear yin-yang kind of polarity and role, and you can see where each of them might be tend to get hung up, you know, that little sister kind of wants to nurture things, but then maybe wants to keep them too much the same. And then little brother, you know, is a little wild and crazy and, you know, could just fragment things all to pieces, wreck everything. Where would the main initiatory point of the woman be in the story? I would think at the end, with the test of the queen, as she keeps coming back. You know, it's the ultimate test of her groundedness, of her determination, her relationship to life. Somehow the test of her connection with her own life force in some way. Beg your pardon? After the birth, right at the end of the tale, I would see the queen's determination to come back that can overcome even the most negative kinds of things that will affirm life no matter what. Although this is sort of a recurrent theme, I think the faithfulness, I mean, you might say this, the initiation isn't as dramatic, it's sort of continual, you know, kind of a test of faith that kind of endures through as came out earlier, through the whole story, the faithfulness to the spark of life, the source of life, undramatic and yet persistent and receptive and... So it's not quite as dramatic, but I thought the end was the most dramatic, you know, the most, stood out the most to me, this coming back, and after being kind of boiled alive and tested totally by the terrible witch in full force, you know, that's like the final confrontation with kind of the core of all that's been the problem all along, you know, live or die. Yeah, it is. It's a sort of a reincarnation.
Her midlife crisis.
Her midlife crisis, yeah. Yeah, it is. Has that sense of persisting when there seems to be no outer hope. You know, when one really is in the depths, when one really descends into the darkness, you know, like would be most typical of a severe midlife situation, could be other things. There's that determination to keep coming back when somehow, at some level, everything looks so black. Logic would say everything's hopeless, no matter what. And that persistent faith in life, despite the fact that one feels or sees no life in some way. Yeah. Oh, the ending of the wicked mother. Oh, the envy and jealousy. Well, it's mentioned in the tale that how the envy of the witch mother and her one-eyed daughter, it's mentioned in the tale toward the end. But yeah, what would you say? It is just jargon, but very narcissistic parents are envious of the life that's in their child, and especially if the child carries certain kind of threatening symbolism for them. And, you know, kind of even hates the child for being alive, so to speak. And but for the child, this is, of course, quite incomprehensible because it takes everything into itself. It doesn't think the parent has any flaw whatsoever. And so it just thinks this means it's sort of integrated as a pervasive sense of badness. And so I mentioned that envy and jealousy experienced in early developmental life is the most difficult of all early developmental emotions to assimilate later in life. the person usually ends up, the individual who's experienced this, as being just terribly resentful and rageful about life in general. And the difficult thing that I mentioned in psychotherapy is that they must see how desperate and needy the parent had to have been to have this sort of envy toward their own child. And in a certain way, almost to have empathy for the parent. And then they have to give up their rage in a certain way. And this is very, very difficult because, you know, this has sort of been the source of their life. And, you know, there's been this sort of addiction that was mentioned earlier to the rage. And yet if they don't see the reality of the situation as it was in early times, they'll never be free. They'll just be reactive, rageful people, full of resentment, hypersensitivities, without any real course or direction in life, and poor relationships. Hey, Carl?
Speaking of that, either do you have any, remember any tales that kind of talk about that, or part of that, but if a person chooses to be rageful and somehow does it create a kind of
tales for people choose to be rageful and come out of it. I'd have to think a while. They choose to be rageful. No tale comes to me offhand. I'm sure I could dig up some. That anyone else can think of a tale where somebody chooses to be rageful then comes out of it? I mean, rage and so forth is common in tales, but choosing to be rageful. It's common to be tested by rage, but to choose it. I suppose any... Oh, the robber bridegroom, yeah. Oh, I thought of one, though. There's the frog prince is a little bit like that. When the young woman loses a ring or something in the well, and then there's a frog down there that helps her, but he makes her promise to bring him into the palace or something, he'll get any wish if, or something like that, if he helps, he gets a ring or whatever she drops. The golden ball? Is it a ball she drops in there? Yeah. But anyway, she seems to choose to be rageful. But it ends up her rage, of course, heals her because she ends up, when she throws the frog against the wall finally, it turns into a prince. So there's a transformation in that case, which would take a whole other kind of analysis to figure out. But these are very basic psychic stances, which all of us experience to some degree. It's just that people with weaker egos and weaker sense of self, it's much more intense and dangerous. Well, it looks like that's about exhausted everyone for this evening, so I thank you very much, and good evening. Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.